Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com, and this is anti-war news for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. The top story at antiwar.com today, the U.S. announces $4.5 billion in aid for Ukraine, and this is what they call direct budgetary aid. And this was announced by Janet Yellen. She said that the new funds will bring total U.S. budgetary aid for Ukraine to $13 billion, and more is coming as Ukraine expects the U.S. to help pay for its massive budget deficit in 2023. So the aid is being dispersed by the U.S. through the World Bank, and according to the U.S. Agency for International Development, that's USAID, the funds will be sent to Ukraine in two tranches before the end of 2022. So they're going to get it over there pretty quick. And this budgetary aid, the idea of it is to fund Ukrainian government services and things like that. So USAID, they're saying that there will be robust safeguards and third-party monitoring to ensure that there's transparency in the use of these funds. But who knows, you know, once that they get over there, who knows how much real oversight there will actually be. And, you know, before Russia's invasion, the U.S. and its Western allies, you know, Ukraine's corruption was pretty, it was talked about a lot. You know, it's a notoriously corrupt government. And the U.S. and its allies would often cite corruption in the Ukrainian government as a reason why the country couldn't join NATO and the EU. President Biden did it back in 2021. I remember he came out and said that, you know, no NATO membership soon. They got to work on corruption. Well, a year later, I mean, how many tens of billions has he sent over to this government that has consolidated more power since the invasion? Of course, that happens with war. But, you know, banning opposition and now they're nationalizing all these companies. And the U.S. just keeps this aid spigot open and the funds flowing. So when it comes to oversight, you know, as I went over last week, a group of House Republicans led by Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, they introduced the bill to audit all U.S. aid to Ukraine. And the bill is likely going to get voted down by Democrats. But Greene did say she would reintroduce the bill when Republicans have the majority in the House after the new Congress is sworn in January. Now, for the most part, the majority of Republicans are still very much in favor of spending money on this war. But even the ones that support it have, a lot of them have said that they would agree to more oversight measures. So maybe this bill would get some support, but I don't know if it will get enough, you know, to pass. And the $4.5 billion, so the state of the aid right now is that funds are still being pulled out of the last aid package that they authorized, I think, in September. So that's where this $4.5 billion is coming from. And the White House is looking for Congress to approve more because they're going to run out of that soon. And they want them to approve a $37.7 billion aid package during the lame duck period before the next Congress comes in. And that would bring total U.S. spending on the war to about $105 billion. And included in this request is in the $37.7 billion request is $14.5 billion in this direct budgetary aid. So more is on the way. All right, the next one here, the CIA is looking to recruit Russian spies. So the CIA's deputy director of intelligence made his first public appearance this week. And he used the opportunity to say that the agency is looking to recruit Russians who are unhappy with the war in Ukraine. This is got this from the Wall Street Journal. So David Marlowe, who is this official, he took his post in June 2021. He said that the CIA is looking around the world for Russians who are, as he put it, disgusted with Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. He said that the spy agency is open for business. So former CIA officials have said that the agency is looking to recruit military officers and Russian billionaires who have had their finances impacted by Western sanctions on Russia. So, you know, people that have had their assets, offshore assets seized, they're looking to exploit, I guess, their anger over the sanctions to turn it around on on Russia, even though, you know, they probably are more mad at the West, at the people that are actually stealing their assets and their money. So the agency, the CIA, has made public efforts to recruit Russians inside Russia, to recruit assets and spies inside Russia earlier in the war. So the way the CIA does this, they set up a website on the dark web for potential spies to make contact using virtual private networks, VPNs, which allow users to circumvent geographic internet restrictions. You know, it shows your IP address is somewhere else. Back in May, the CIA released instructions in Russian. They posted this on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and other social media sites on how to access the dark website to make contact. And so they're trying to get a hold of Russians this way. And another thing that they're doing, that the U.S. government is doing, is that they've increased, since Russia invaded Ukraine, they increased the funding of VPN companies. So the U.S. government actually funds things like this. And this is part of how they support protesters and dissidents in countries, you know, that are targeted by the U.S. Countries that have governments that the U.S. doesn't like, you know, Russia, Iran, Belarus, for example. And in this specific case, this was from a Reuters report that I wrote up months ago. Their idea for this VPN that they're trying to get into Russia was so people could access Voice of America and other U.S. state-funded media outlets. And there's reports that there's posters with QR codes on them around Russian cities that if you scanned it, it would take you to, you know, one of the VPN companies, you know, their software or whatever. And then from there, it would take you to Voice of America. So it's part of how they're trying to, you know, fight an information war against Putin. And they do fund these private companies through this Open Technology Fund, which is a nonprofit that is funded by the U.S. government. And Washington uses this company to support protesters again around the world and to give them tools to avoid surveillance and get around internet censorship. So I bet there's a lot of this going on right now with the people in Iran. And I link to, if you want to read more on this, because it is just a way that the U.S. kind of meddles in other countries that a lot of people aren't aware of. I link to an article that I wrote up a few years ago when the protests in Hong Kong were going on, and it about how the U.S. was supporting those protesters through this fund. Okay, so the next one, this is interesting. So the AP has fired a reporter after that whole mess where they cited an anonymous senior intelligence official who said a Russian missile landed in Poland, setting off all these concerns about World War III, NATO, Article 5. This happened right after there was reports that a missile hit Poland, and then this went out, and of course it's AP, so it went everywhere. So they fired this guy, James Laporta, who is the reporter. But this article from Semaphore, this website I haven't heard of before, but this is a good, interesting article here. They got the screenshots of the Slack conversation that the AP reporters had. So they fired James Laporta, and he's the one that in this, if you look at this Slack conversation, he says that, you know, from a senior U.S. intelligence official, yes, Russian missiles crossed into Poland. At least two people are dead from initial reports. Also, missiles entered Moldova. No casualties at this time. And then he had other editors say, can we use this? Can we put this out? And he actually said, that call is above my pay grade. So somebody else made the decision. And in this Slack, there's this other editor or reporter, Vanessa Guerra is her name. She's saying that they should put it out because the Polish government said that they called like a crisis emergency meeting of their security cabinet. And she said, I can't imagine a U.S. intelligence official would be wrong on this. So, I mean, and then they put it out and they fired the guy who originally got the got this scoop. But it's a good article, and it just shows, it says, you know, a 10-minute miscommunication on Slack between journalists at the Associated Press resulted in an erroneous report last week that appeared momentarily to bring tensions between NATO and Russia to their highest point since the Cuban Missile Crisis. It really just goes to show, again, it's they fired the guy. You know, there was definitely going to be some reckoning for this. And it looks like they fired the guy that was kind of lowest on the totem pole, you know, just based on the fact that he said it was above his pay grade. And he also said it was vetted by somebody who I guess is at Ron Nixon, somebody at AP that vets this kind of stuff. But apparently it wasn't really vetted properly. So that was another issue. So yeah, that's that. And they're still protecting the identity of the source, which I think, you know, we have the right to know who put that out there. All right, the next one here. So the U.S. has broken its silence on Turkey's operations in northern Syria and Iraq against the Kurds. And they're saying that Turkey has the right to defend themselves. So the White House said on Tuesday that Turkey has the right to defend themselves from Kurdish militant groups in northern Syria and Iraq following massive Turkish airstrikes in the region. So this is from John Kirby. He's a spokesman for the National Security Council. He said, quote, Turkey does continue to suffer a legitimate terrorist threat, particularly to their south. They certainly have every right to defend themselves and their citizens, end quote. So this is a pretty major shift, I believe, in how the U.S. usually approaches Turkey's operations in northern Syria. They usually condemn them, you know, not too strongly. It's not like they ever threatened to intervene and fight Turkey, but just say to see the White House say this, it's pretty big shift. So they launched this big operation, Turkey did, in response to the Istanbul bombing, which they blamed on the PKK and its Syrian affiliates, which include the U.S.-backed SDF. And the operations killed members of the SDF, that's the U.S. ally there. And they responded by firing rockets. So Kirby's only warning, basically, was that the Turkish assault could impact U.S. and SDF operations against ISIS. He's just saying that it could distract everything against ISIS. So the U.S., again, typically condemns these type of actions by Turkey, but they're not doing so now, likely, I think, because they want Turkey to approve Sweden and Finland's NATO bids. And this comes after, you know, Turkish officials are blaming the U.S. for this flare up in violence because of their support for the Kurds. So to see this response, I mean, I think they really want Turkey to approve that NATO membership. And the State Department, they actually issued a statement on Monday night that I missed, but it was very short. Just said that they urged de-escalation, no condemnation. So it's a big shift. And I can't stop thinking about back in 2019 when President Trump said he was going to pull out of Syria. So Turkey was going in to fight the Kurds again, and he moved some troops out of the way. And he said he was going to pull out, and everybody just lost their minds about the Kurds. I remember I wrote an article about it and just put in all these quotes. Everybody in Congress just totally went crazy about, oh, how could you abandon the Kurds? And now you see this and nothing, you know, there's no outrage. Nobody seems to care. And the next one here, so Erdogan is threatening a ground offensive. So he said this on Tuesday. He's threatening a ground offensive in northern Syria as soon as possible. And again, it comes after these major airstrikes. I'll just read the quote that he put in here. He said, quote, we have been bearing down on terrorists for a few days with our planes, cannons, and guns. God willing, we will root out all of them as soon as possible, together with our tanks, our soldiers, end quote. And also the Turkish Defense Ministry is claiming that they killed 184 Kurdish fighters. That's a lot. And that number isn't confirmed. I haven't really seen any other big death tolls like that. So it's not clear if that's right, but that's a lot. So it's a pretty major operation. And Erdogan does kind of threaten this stuff a lot, but this is different because it's coming after they just launched these huge airstrikes. All right, so the next one here, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin holds in-person talks with his Chinese counterpart. So he met with Wang Fenghe, who is the Chinese defense minister, in Cambodia on Tuesday, as the U.S. and China continue to maintain high-level dialogue following the meeting between President Biden and President Xi Jinping. Austin and Wei, they agreed to resume military communication channels that Beijing suspended in response to Nancy Pelosi visiting Taiwan, but the meeting was still tense. So a Pentagon official, and this just gives you, it just shows, you know, the U.S. attitude to all this stuff with China. A Pentagon official said after the meeting that despite the increase in communication, the U.S. still believes competition remains the defining feature of the relationship between the two nations. Austin and Wei, they delivered warnings over Taiwan, which is the most sensitive issue between the two powers at this time, it seems. In recent years, the U.S. has been increasing support for Taiwan, which China views as moving away from the one China policy that was agreed on when the U.S. and China normalized relations in the 1970s. The Pentagon said in a readout of the meeting that Austin underscored his opposition to what they say are unilateral changes to the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. But Wei told Austin that it was the U.S., not China, that is looking to change the status quo. Wei reiterated that this issue is, you know, one of their core interests, and it's a red line that must never be crossed, which Xi delivered a similar warning to Biden during the talks that they held recently. And again, Xi told Biden that the state of U.S.-China relations are in nobody's interest and that they should work to put them back on track. But Biden approached the talks as a managing of tensions rather than a serious rapprochement. So that's what we're seeing from the U.S. You know, they want to manage the competition, as they say. And that's what it is. You know, it's not going to get better than that between the two countries. All right. So Kamala Harris made another, gave a speech in the Philippines on Palawan, which is the Philippine island on the South China Sea. So I've been going over this a lot. I'll just go through this quick because she said some new stuff on Tuesday. And she said it on board a Philippine Coast Guard vessel. She didn't mention China by name, but, you know, she was clearly referencing Beijing in her speech. She said, quote, "We must stand up for principles such as respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity, unimpeded lawful commerce, the peaceful resolution of disputes, and the freedom of navigation and overflight in the South China Sea and throughout the Indo-Pacific," end quote. And just the day before, which I went over yesterday, when she met with President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., she vowed to defend the Philippines in the South China Sea. She reaffirmed that an attack on Philippine vessels in the waters would invoke mutual defense commitments under the 1951 Mutual Defense Treaty, meaning that the U.S. is saying it's willing to go to war with China if an encounter between Philippine and Chinese vessels ever turns in, you know, deadly, or if shots are fired or something like that. And while she was there, she announced new cooperation with the Philippines to cut down on illegal fishing. So a major part of the dispute between China and other Southeast Asian countries in the South China Sea and their claims to the waters is over who can fish in what areas. That's a big part of it. And there's other resources there. There's oil and gas. And I know Vietnam and China are trying to work out a deal on some, I'm not sure. I think it's gas reserves that are off Vietnam's coast, but in the area that China claims. So they're trying to work out a deal with that. But so there is a lot of resources, but a lot of it is fishing. And Harris is saying that the U.S. is going to give new funding to the Philippines law enforcement to help them combat this. So that's where we're at there. But that was her last day in the Philippines, so you're not going to have to hear about her over there anymore. All right, the next one here. The Israeli military chief tells the U.S. to step up planning for joint attacks on Iran. So the head of the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, is pressing the U.S. to step up planning for joint offensives against Iran. This is according to the Times of Israel. So IDF Chief of Staff Aviv Kohavi arrived in the U.S. on Sunday and he's been holding talks with high-level officials. So far this week, he has met with Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and CIA Director William Burns. And he said, this is a summary of some of these talks that he said. He said, quote, during the discussions, it was agreed that we are at a critical point in time that requires the acceleration of operational plans and cooperation against Iran and its terrorist proxies in the region, end quote. So tensions are very high right now between the U.S. and Iran. The U.S. keeps increasing sanctions. I haven't even really been going over all the sanctions that they've been adding. A lot of them really are kind of meaningless at this point because Iran is under so many sanctions. But it is, you know, symbolic, and they are targeting companies in Asia that are helping Iran circumvent sanctions. So how effective those sanctions are, I don't really know, like, if these companies in Asia are going to stop because of the U.S. sanctions, are going to stop transporting Iranian oil. And the U.S. is voicing support for protesters inside the country, and talks to revive the nuclear deal have been stalled for months, and there's no sign that they're going to be revived. So the U.S. recently acknowledged in its nuclear posture review that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, but Israel continues to hype up the threat of Iran's nuclear program. Kohavi said on the one hand, he said, quote, on the one hand, Iran is under many economic, military, and internal pressures. And on the other hand, it continues to promote its nuclear program. The IDF strongly promotes all operational plans against the Iranian threat, end quote. So as he's been the head of the IDF, they've been preparing, they've been planning and doing more operational planning for attacks on Iran. They've simulated bombing Iran in the Mediterranean Sea. The question is, can they do it without the U.S.? I don't think so right now. So I think that's part of the reason why they want, you know, these joint plans. It'll make it a lot easier for them to bomb facilities in Iran. But, you know, it's Israel. It's something they're always talking about. It doesn't mean that there's any kind of major attacks on Iran coming soon, but it's important to always highlight and see the thinking that's going on there between the U.S. and Israel. All right, the next one here, this is from Jason Ditz. So Iran is reported to have increased enrichment rates. Well, it hasn't increased enrichment rates, but it's increased. So its highest level that it enriches uranium at is 60%, which is still below the 90% needed for weapons grade. So they're saying now that they're going to do a little more 60% enrichment, and it comes after the IAEA voted to condemn Iran over aspects of its nuclear program. Again, there's still no sign that they're trying to make a weapon, and they're only they're enriching at 60%. They did that in response to an Israeli covert attack on one of their nuclear facilities. Before that, 20% was the highest. And they did that in response to an Israeli assassination inside Iran at the end of 2020. So you see what causes them to increase their enrichment, the same things that Israel wants to do more of. And there's often hype about, you know, having a stockpile of 60% enriched uranium, which right now it's very small. But even if they have a big stockpile, they can't do anything with it. They can't turn it into a nuclear weapon. It has to be at 90%. So it's all a lot of hype. But Iran knows, you know, they use this as leverage for negotiations. And I think they're still trying to settle things with the IAEA. You know, there's no sign of negotiations with the U.S. anytime soon. But, you know, Britain, France, and Germany, they came out and condemned this already. And just so, you know, if people aren't aware, the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, that limits Iran's enrichment levels to 3.67%. It's very, very low. And so, you know, if they really cared about this type of stuff, getting back into that deal would be the priority for Israel and the U.S. and the European countries as well. But all right, that's it for the news. Actually, we have one last one here. So the Biden administration, they've granted immunity to MBS, the Crown Prince, in a lawsuit over Jamal Khashoggi, who is the Washington Post columnist who was killed in Turkey in a Saudi consulate. So a lot of people are upset about that because, you know, President Biden vowed to make this guy and Saudi Arabia in general a pariah, but that has not happened. And the U.S., this is from the Middle East Eye, the U.S. is continuing to review its relationship with Saudi Arabia, despite a Biden administration decision that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman should be provided immunity from a lawsuit over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Tuesday. So he's saying that the opinion over this case, it has nothing to do with then how they're reevaluating ties and everything. But that's it for the news for today. We have a lot of good viewpoints. One from Ted Snyder about titled "It Was Never About Ukraine," and he mentions a quote from Ned Price back in March. I remember because I wrote an article about it, and so this is March 21st, so not long after the invasion started, and he was asked if you support a negotiated settlement between Zelensky and Putin, between Russia and Ukraine. And what he said, Price's response was, "This is a war that is in many ways bigger than Russia. It's bigger than Ukraine." So, you know, they were against negotiations from the beginning and saying that the war was about this abstract idea that a country has the right to choose its, you know, military, its alignment, you know, about the whole NATO thing. So, yeah, it was really something. I remember that quote. It's just like how they were very clearly against negotiations in the beginning, and they have changed that a little bit, and even like their public statements. But in the beginning there, it was really very, do you have plans to negotiate with Russia? They just, no, not at this time. Those were their answers. And then we also have one from Ahmed Adel about the, oh, whoops, looks like I'm not logged in here, about the G20 summit. About how Western attempts to isolate Russia at the G20 summit failed. But that's it for me for today. I'll be back tomorrow. And you can support the show, antiwar.com/donate, like and share and subscribe and all that good stuff. Share it around. Tell your friends about it. Post it on social media, all that stuff. But I'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Thanks for listening.